The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Our guest, Morgan Parker, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Magical Negro, a poetry collection that ponders the nuances of Black American womanhood. She is also the author of the young adult novel, Who Put This Song On?, and the poetry collections, Other People's Comfort Keeps Me Up at Night, and There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé. A Kaweah Kahnem Graduate Fellow, the recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, and the winner of a Pushcart Prize, Parker is the creator, co-creator of the Poets with Attitude reading series, and is a member of the Other Black Girl Collective. In her new book, You Get What You Pay For, she charts the generational and historical difficulties, traumas, and beauties of existing as a Black woman. Ms. Parker will be in conversation tonight with Chantrell Lewis, a multi-hyphen creative and scholar who accesses multiple disciplines to help elucidate African diasporic history, aesthetics, culture, and spirituality. Her critically acclaimed directorial debut in Our Mother's Gardens was released on Netflix via Ava DuVernay's Array, and her book Dandelion, The Black Dandy and Street Style was published by Aperture in 2017. As an initiated Lukumi Sango priest, Hoodooist, and New Orleans native, Chantrell can be found waxing poetic about all things African spirituality online and in person at the Boku Hoodoo Shop and the annual Boku Hoodoo Fest this October. Please welcome our guests.
Hey, boo. I'm talking to you, Morgan.
Hi. Thanks for being here with me.
Morgan's like, just staring into the abyss of the lights. So just to give you all the audience a little preface to this talk, we are not strangers to each other. We are friends. We have been on each other for over a decade. Like about at least 15 years, I think.
Probably.
When you were at Mokada, like, were you
that was school? I was maybe in grad school or just right out of grad school. So yeah, like yeah. 2012-ish.
Yeah, that was a long time.
That was a long time ago.
Which I think tends to make for, you know, better conversations in these settings, right? Because it's not just like, I don't know, I'm just talking to someone who's just like interacting with the work, but like really interacting with the person. Mm-hmm. So that said, first of all, let me start by congratulating you. This is book number 4 or 5.
5.
Yes, that's a big old number, girl.
It's a big number. Thank you very much.
That is a huge, huge, huge accomplishment, particularly at your age, to have committed yourself to doing your work, to doing this work, not allowing all of these thoughts to remain in your head, but mm-hmm. getting in and putting it out in the world. I remember when my younger cousin, knew that, you know, we were friends, and she was just like fangirl, and was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. And so I was like, I felt cool, like a cool big cousin and shit. So I just want to congratulate you. This book is funny. It's really smart. It's very honest. It's super vulnerable, and I can imagine, so I have my own thoughts and feelings, like, and I don't know if I can really divorce myself from knowing you and my thoughts and feelings and reactions to it, but I can imagine it was a little challenging to write.
Yes, it took longer than any other book. I got a whole new psychiatrist. Like, I took a long break. It was supposed to come out hella years ago. Like, it really was a complicated labor. And that is just how it is sometimes, you know? Like, I struggled with myself mm-hmm. writing this. And at some point, I just had to, like, kind of relinquish and let myself catch up in order to make the book, instead of just kind of like hounding myself about why the book wasn't happening and why I couldn't just like push through. And I think I've always written very vulnerable, honest. I've written about most all of these themes, you know, in all of my books. So it wasn't, I was kind of like, I don't understand why I can't do this. It is my first book of essays, and there's something about the form, the personal essay form, that is vulnerable in a different kind of way.
Right.
I mean, my young adult novel, though, it's like fiction, but like the character's name is Morgan Parker. So it's not like this was
right.
Yeah, but there was something. I also think, you know, writing about mental health, someone was telling me yesterday at my event that, like, it just seems like you've understood it and you've gotten past it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you live with depression, but you know, you're through it, mm-hmm. sort of thing. If you can write about it in this way,
right.
That is no. Not even close, you know?
Right.
And there's something to writing about the worst times of my life and the most depressed times of my life while going through probably like the second worst times of my life. But that's not, and you know, not necessarily wanting that to come into the writing, sometimes wanting to allow it to come into the, you know, like where is that line? And for me, when I'm depressed, I have a lot of trouble trusting myself, obviously, my instincts. One thing that always grounds me as a writer in craft is always like coming back to my instincts. Mm-hmm. But when your instincts are telling you to die, you don't want to trust that instinct. Mm-hmm. I'm like, we're going right there, question number one. But that, I mean, that was the hardest part of writing this book, was that I just really... I'm usually such a good self-editor, and I usually try to put all of myself into each piece, but it felt at times very dangerous to do so. Mm. And that also, a lot of this was during, you know, going through a pandemic, mm-hmm. and I had moved across the country, so I didn't have my usual support around me. So it really was challenging. So I will say, you know, the book came out yesterday, and I will say this week it's different for me than any other book release, because it does feel like it represents something else. An accomplishment, yes, but it also kind of encapsulates a period that was at times very dark. But for that reason, you know, I got the finished copies and was like, okay, this is an object that is separate from the experience that made it. This object has a whole different juju, you know, like I just have been ready to like let it be something else, you know, because that's the whole point when I'm writing. I'm like, this is hell. I'm writing about, I mean, I'm like, I cry reading this. Mm. And it hurts, but there's a reason I do that, you know, and it's never been the wrong impulse. Mm-hmm. You know, every time I like do a reading and some black girl gives me a hug, I'm like, okay, yeah. That's why, you know what I mean?
Right.
That's why I do that. And you know, we write to communicate. So that really, that interaction is important. So this part is the best part, you know, of this book, because the writing really was a challenge. And it also, you know, being a poet, I care so deeply about every single word,
mm-hmm.
every single word. So it was like, my editor kept being like, just give me a draft. And I'm like, I'm out here counting syllables. I'm reading everything out loud. Like, it's not exactly that word. It's not potent. It's something else. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I just really being obsessive about utilizing language in the best way possible, mm. in a way that not all essayists, I think, are focused. So for me, like, the argument of an essay was, you know, equally as important to the language that is being used to make that argument.
Right.
So it was a lot of like different sides of the writing brain happening at once, plus my heart, you know, on top of that.
Which is very evident. And it's interesting when, you know, when I was preparing for the conversation, I was going to ask you how deep you want to go. I was like, do you want to keep it nice and cute? You know, like we just have a nice little key, or do you want to go there and then you just like jump right in? So
here it is.
Thank you for, you know, I'm a Gemini, you're
Sag. Life is short. Yeah, here we go.
Thank you for making that decision for me. I will say, so you talk about like how challenging it was to write, right? It was very challenging for me to read.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to tell you why. And for the audience, those of you who may not, you know me, I'm from the South. I'm from New Orleans, to be exact. So I'm a Gen Xer. Morgan is a millennial. And I think that I feel like I'm always engaged in, like, generation wars. Mm-hmm. Because, and I'm at the tail end, but I feel like we do look at the world very differently because there was, like, different things happening in the world as we were coming into the world and coming into ourselves and our identities, right? But all that said, I mean, we have more similarities than we have differences, and yet we also have these, like, nuances that are differences that I think made me very frustrated when I was reading the book. I felt like a big cousin or mm-hmm. older sister, and I wanted to give you a hug. I almost want to cry right now. I wanted to give you a hug. I was upset for you.
Mm-hmm.
I was upset that as a Black woman, you know, I'm like so emotional right now. I was not expecting this.
I'm sorry.
But I mean, it's clearly.
It's real. It's real. Yeah.
I think that I was frustrated at the times when you felt so like isolated and alone,
mm-hmm.
that like some of the issues that you were wrestling with at such a young age,
mm-hmm.
And then that like stay with you, that you're constantly having to fight against and wrestle against, namely white supremacy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Being a Black woman and I say largely because the whole world is not, we are impacted by white supremacy, but there are parts of the world and parts of humanity where white supremacy and whiteness does not have its hold.
It doesn't
right?
reign, yeah.
But it made me very frustrated for you,
mm.
right? Because there were parts of this that, you definitely let us in, invited us into like some of these, like the dark recesses of your mind, mm-hmm. and this level of vulnerability. But that as a Black woman, parts that I haven't even experienced,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? Because unlike you, I grew up in New Orleans, which is predominantly Black.
Yep.
You talk about
New
Orleans culture wars. We're going to get into that in the book without naming it. I was like, oh.
I know. I meant to just be like, oh, by the way. But I was like, that'll just be funny when she reads
it. It was hilarious because I almost had to go. I'm going to tell y'all the inside joke so y'all could be a part of it as well. But, you know, so some of these things I don't have to wrestle with,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, one of the first questions, and I'm going to try to ask this in a way that is not going to force you to feel like you have to defend.
Uh-huh.
But it's a question that I wrestle with as a young girl because, like, you talk about your childhood. You start at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about your childhood, and you was this precocious, smart, nerdy, inquisitive, preoccupied with God. Me too.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a Catholic school.
Yep.
K through 12. So it was like God, books, and boys. That's my journal.
Yeah.
I was boy crazy. I'm a Gemini. My husband was like, but I still say I'm boy crazy. He was like, you said that in present tense.
Yeah.
Like, does it ever go away? Like, once boy crazy, like, not always boy crazy. But anyway, we were talking about polyamory and stuff like just a second ago and dating and blah, 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 blah. But anyway, the point that, and if my husband is listening to this, which he probably is, that I am, you know, happily boy crazy monogamous, but I'm just saying.
You
can have conversations and thoughts and whatnot. But the point that I was trying to make was that I had those things similar to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember since, you know, you'd start in the beginning, once you all get the book from Uncle Bobby's downstairs, if you haven't already gotten a copy, then you'll start at the beginning as well, unless you're one of those people that just start in the middle somewhere when you read a book. You know, you talk about, like, you know, growing up in school and what you watch on TV and all this stuff. I remember growing up when I would pass by, I was going to a predominantly Black Catholic school, and we would pass by a Catholic school that was nearer my house, but it was predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always see like two or three little Black kids on the schoolyard playing by themselves.
It was young MP, just me, Morgan. I was starting a publishing house. That's what I was doing in third grade. They made me disband it because I didn't let everyone join. kids try to get in and I was like, but I've never seen you write anything. I don't know if you can draw. You might have to submit a sample to me.
Like a true sage.
And a businesswoman.
Okay. That goes to what we have to do when we put these situations and scenarios where we like have to fend for our lives and fend for our sanity, right? And so I always wondered, even as a child, what would make a parent put their black child in these schools? And so even in like, so I'm going to get to a part, right? There's a chapter when Morgan talks about a diaspora. And she talks about an experience in Amsterdam at a literary festival.
Chantrell inviting me.
That I curated, because I was reading it, and I was like, that was the literary festival I invited Morgan to. I thought maybe it was like a different one, right? And she, you know, she doesn't name us, but clearly, you know, she's like, you know, friends from New Orleans and the Bronx and all these places. And she talks about how we get into conversations about, like, not even diaspora wars, but because she talks about that, but also, like, black wars within the U.S., right? Like, whose city is the blackest?
Right.
Because I'm like, I'm from New Orleans. I'm like, ain't no city in the U.S. blacker and more African than New Orleans.
Yeah.
And then you have, like, you know, folks in Chicago and D.C. That was actually like a real heated argument that took place between two writers who were both from Louisiana.
Meanwhile, there's all these Dutch black people that we're connecting with, but we're all white.
Right.
It's just like
getting into these conversations. But like, I mean, so, and you said, and then here I am in the Netherlands, I'm feeling othered, right? And just for context also, I've been doing work in the Netherlands like the past, like long time. So I'm going back and forth to like look at black Dutchness and relative to black U.S.-ness.
Yep, yep.
And I've learned a lot being in that context, like, the hegemony that exists even within Afro-America.
Yep.
It wasn't until I went to Washington, D.C., to Howard University, though, that I did understand how nuanced blackness is, right? And so I'm saying all that to say, just to give y'all context, like, I noticed your frustration, and I feel like, damn, like, you felt othered in that space, even that conversation, because you were like, what about, like, black girls like me who grew up in Southern California who can't claim this type of identity proximity to blackness because of my experience? Well, what about me?
So I'm less black. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, okay. But that's not, we can't go off of geography that way. You know, it's difficult. And I think it's something that we don't think about a lot. It's something that, you know, Western blacks have to think about, because there is a lot of, because we're so starved for ourselves, that we're reaching for these things to claim, you know? We're reaching for, yes, this is, here we go, free blacks, here we go, you know, we got true traces of Africa. Ain't none in the California suburbs, you know? I'm not being able to, like, reach down and find myself anywhere there. But that's just where I was born. You know what I mean? And I think there's something about, obviously, all black people want to claim blackness. So we can't couch it, of course, in location. You know, blackness has never been contained in that way. But there's a desire that we all have. So it's like we all want to have some kind of supremacy, you know, over blackness. And it is a thing where I've had to... The other part is, you know, being raised and, you know, among so many whites, is I've already struggled to claim my blackness, right? Especially because, you know, I'm growing up, it's colorblind. You know, you're not black, you're Morgan. So I'm already struggling to find my own ownership, right? So even getting older, moving out, I'm like, I live in Bed-Stuy, you know what I mean? But it doesn't matter, because I don't have this sort of claim. And yeah, that experience was just so interesting to me, because there was real pain. There was a real pain. And I understood it, but at the same time, I was like, we're all feeling that same pain, just like in different kinds of ways. It's not about each other. And it was really striking to me the ways that we were able to have these really cool, in-depth conversations with black Dutch writers. And yet when we seemingly have more in common as black writers from the US, we felt more kind of separate and, you know, I mean, that's often why I'm like, this is why we can't have revolution. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But usually we think of it as a white supremacist thing that's keeping us separately.
Right.
But there's an internal thing that often keeps us splintering off, you know? And that's something that I'm just have always been interested in. And like, yeah, I don't know.
I want to apologize. And for the group, right, for just that you had that experience. Because for me, I think I take, like, I went to the Netherlands, and it really had me realize my black privilege.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Being able to go, live in a city where there are not one, two, but three all-black Catholic high schools.
Yep.
Yeah. Right? Where, like, I can go to, like, a private schools and be around all black kids. That is a privilege.
Yep.
Going to Howard University, you know, like to me, there is no institution higher than no Harvard, no Princeton, no mm-hmm. Penn can even touch Howard mm-hmm. because of the level of dynamism and diversity that exists with even Black America. That is the holy grail for me. That's the Mecca. Then coming to Philly, another Black city where, mm-hmm. by the way, my ancestors apparently lived in the late 1700s here.
Wow.
Their son, one having been born free in Philadelphia, one came here from Haiti during the Haitian Revolution. Their son went down to New Orleans and became U.S. diplomat to Haiti under Frederick Douglass. And then the mother of the woman who came from Haiti, she was born in Africa in 1764,
wow.
found that out. Last name, same thing,
wow.
Lewis, lived here in Philadelphia. So I feel like I've walked through the world having a sense of identity,
yes, yeah.
because of my genealogy, and looking at, oh, this is what black privilege looks like, right?
Most of us do not get that. You know what I mean?
And is it most of us? So that's the thing that I want to push back on, because like one of the questions I wanted to know, like who is your audience for this book? Like, is it like black people like me who you're saying most of us don't have this experience? Is it like the awkward black girl in the room? Like, I see you, I know you, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is it white people? Is it like all of us? Like, who's your audience?
I mean, firstly is always me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, firstly is always me. Like, there's always going to be like weird inside jokes in my book that are just for me. Like, no one's going to laugh. It's just like I hear it in my voice as a joke to myself. And it's usually about me working something out for myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then it's like people who maybe have had similar experiences to me
mm-hmm.
or are curious about experiences such as mine, you know, but then it's like anyone who will listen, you know, and then it's like, do you care about other, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's really just about like, I'm gonna really lay something out. And if you're interested in really taking a walk along someone else's kind of perspective, then I'll show you, you know what I mean? But you have to listen. And I think for me, I'm usually talking to black folks, although I feel like for this book, it just was a little bit different. It just kind of jumps around even paragraph to paragraph.
Right.
Like the registers change a lot, which I like doing in poems. It's different in essays
mm-hmm.
because it's like almost like you're putting on different masks or like different jackets for different paragraphs. But And I think that part of it is that I am a performer, and part of growing up as like a black girl and in a white space is knowing how to perform and knowing how to change registers and shift and do asides where it's like, now I'm talking to you. You know what
right.
I mean? So there's a lot of kind of that, which felt important to this book, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like Magical Negroes for Black People, There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyonce is like, this is for black women, all y'all, the rest of y'all, get out of here, you know? So for this one, it really was more of like, I don't know, felt very American, I
mm-hmm,
guess,
mm-hmm,
if
mm-hmm.
nothing else. Like, this is my American experience
mm-hmm,
from
mm-hmm.
the beginning.
Mm-hmm,
and as far back to a beginning I can go to, you know, my genealogy is not, I mean, I'm in wading in, you
mm-hmm.
know, it's gonna take a lot. But more than anything, what I find is that there's so much hidden
mm-hmm.
and it's so hard to find. And that in and of itself is just annoying and like wrong. You know what I mean? The fact that it's like, oh, maybe I can get a grant and go to Utah and go to this library and go and stay there for 8 months and maybe find another Parker. You know what I mean?
Is like, that your genealogy though? Because I was going to ask you, that was actually a question, like, because I can't remember which chapter, but there's like a little small cliff note, like, when you talk about where your identity began, like, have you done that, started doing that work in that
research? Little bit. So both of my parents are from Kentucky. They're both from Lexington. So I can go back kind of far. But, like, here's the thing. A boat was somewhere. And often that is where the story stops for us. In terms of documents. And I think, like, that is the thing that frustrates me the most, is that it's like, it feels, I feel robbed, you know, but I also know that that is by design.
Right.
And so for me, it's more about interrogating, how do we live in a place where we maybe don't have access, or, like, you know what I mean? Like, what if I don't have access ever, you know? Then how do I continue on?
Right.
Maybe I can find something to reach onto. So far, I've gotten to, like, some old maps of Lexington and, like, you know, my family lived in the same little area for generations. But, it gets all confusing. And, you know, people are spelling names different kinds of ways. And the census. And, I mean, it's really hard work in a way that feels like a joke. You know what I mean?
It does. But, and I'm actually, funny enough, doing a genealogy workshop at the end of the month, and I'm inviting...
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, the African-American genealogy group that was founded here in the 80s by a woman named Carolyn Williams to facilitate the conversation. And there, and a part of that workshop is to go beyond the 1865 wall, which I think is so important, because those stories exist. And so it's like, I feel like, again, Big Cousin, I want to push back, because just in the same way that I was able to unlock, which also has to do with, I know in my family tree, being from New Orleans, there's a lot of free black people of color, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, then also a lot of Haitian ancestry, that's a lot of free black people, period.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that's a part of the myth, right? Like, and I was just recently reading about, last in my book club, last month we read a book called Slave Religion by Albert Robitaille. And in it, he begins to talk about the debate between E. Franklin Frazier, who says that we were cut off completely from Africa, and then, you know, who was a black man and who was a sociologist at Howard University. And you had a white man who was also Jewish, Melville Herskovitz, that said, you know, the Negro things of his past are talking about the myth of the Negro past, and actually talking about, like, no, we weren't completely cut off. And so Big Cousin is like, nah, like, those stories are there.
They're there. They're there. It's really is about that access, you know what I mean? And the ease to which we can get that access.
Right.
And I think, you know, especially because it's not like, here are the stories when you're young. You know what I mean? It's mostly like, I don't know. And honestly, my family is, I mean, they're from the South. They're from Kentucky. I say the records are covered in bourbon. So it's all very like, I don't know, Uncle Popeye. I'm like, but what was that guy's name? Well, we never asked. We just called him Uncle Popeye. Huh? Like, you know what I mean? There's just so much work. But, I mean, and that's what I love. That's what I love about black people, and the way that we rewrite our own histories. Where information isn't easily accessible, there is something about being able to reclaim and rewrite and just say, this is what it is because I said so, you know? And I think for me, that has been a more productive way to go, because the more that I look into the past, the more I realize how hard it is to uncover things. And that just frustrates me and pisses me off, because I know that that's by design, and that's like on purpose, like it's being hidden from me. So then I just kind of want to interrogate the need for documentation. You know what I mean? So there, I'm like in between, you know, like the research nerd of me, but also being like, who cares? You know what I mean?
And you brought up, that was something you talk about in a book where you, I think, I don't remember which chapter it is, when you're talking about, like, I don't know if you were in conversation with a white boy or talking to one, and you're like, and he can name all of these resources, right? And you're like, but I just feel the thing.
Yes.
But just because it was almost like your feelings were negated. And, but I'm like, but that's African.
It is.
That's African. And so I'm like, there was so many times that I'm like, but that's the African aesthetic. That's what it means to be African-centered. And so there's actually one part I want to read. It's from A Bale of Cotton, for example. Poet, essayist, and activist June Jordan wrote that Black America embodies the extreme questions of freedom and identity. How can I be who I am? Not who I am. Who am I? I think it's important there's a verb involved, that the question of existence is welded with the question of allowable action. Not how can I be, but how can I be myself? She writes, we mean to rescue the person from the amorality of time and science. The amorality of time claiming to be linear, which I'm inserting white supremacist European construct, right? And science sending our bodies to zoos. We mean to rescue personhood from the boat, rescue the person from the damage incurred in the rupture. Colored people time, this is you, however, its roots have been cut or rotted, is an homage to our pre-American Black sensibilities. And I'm like all in the margins, like, yes, like, right? Yes. Colored people time, African
things.
Time.
Mm-hmm.
Getting there when you get there. Going home when the court lights come on. When I asked my mom my birth time, she told me a little bit before dinner time. So I filled out forms and wrote a check to get an official copy of my birth records. If the astrological implications of an exact timestamp weren't important to me, it would have been a waste of money. I was born at 4:23 p.m. We tell time how we need to. When we say tomorrow, we mean a whole lot more than that. And then, like, skipping down, you say the consequences, and you're quoting, you know, Jordan again, of Black miracle in white America, writes Jordan, all of us hunt identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's here to me, I ask the question, what if we removed white people, right, from the conversation? Because I feel like throughout the book, out of necessity and for your own sanity, you have to name and claim a thing. Because, like, you know, you talk about Zora a lot in the book, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and one of my favorite Zora quotes is that, you know, if we're silent about our pain, they'll kill us. And so I wonder, like, when I talk about Black dandyism in that time before a time when I was doing that work, I think sometimes we prescribe something to whiteness when it's really Black, right? Like, because I know you talked about, like, gold chains, and it makes you think about, like, chains and chattel slavery and all of these different things. And so, I when I talk about dandyism, I'm like, when Black people were dressing up in Harlem, they were doing so in the absence of white people.
Yes, they weren't going downtown.
And so I wonder,
they're dressing up for each other.
For each other. Which predated whiteness and colonial, you know, like the being colonial subject and being othered. So I wonder if ever you can imagine a world where we don't even have to think about ourselves in comparison to white people and whiteness. Is it even possible for you? And I'm not asking that. That's not coming from a place of judgment. I'm asking out of curiosity.
Yeah.
Do you think it's possible? Because you've interrogated this so much. And I mean, like, you know, even I really felt you when you talked about white girlness, right? But it also made me frustrated for you as well. Because I'm like, the shit that makes you dope.
I know.
You should have never even had to question.
I know. I hate it too. And it really was a thing. It's like, writing the stuff too, there were so many things where it was like, oh, my big cousins are going to come for me. You know what I mean? But it's really like, I wish that I could get there, but I've been there, and there's not, like, there's a way that some of that stuff, if you're on the playground and this girl says one thing, like, that's gonna be in my head. That helped shape who I am and how I understand myself in relation to the rest of the world. And I think, you know, it's like, I wish that I could just be like, but, you know, I've moved on and da-da-da, but it really doesn't happen that way. And I think so much of my life, I've tried to pretend that that stuff doesn't still haunt me in the same ways, and that's not useful either. You know what I mean? Especially because it's, like, usually with Black folks, because I know that it's ridiculous, and I know that I shouldn't have to feel that way, and I know that a lot of other Black folks don't. Because of, you know, what generation they're from or where they went to school or whatever. So I understand it to be a thing. Like, it's like, but I'm like, I've been in therapy for, like, you know what I mean? 30
time.
Years. So
right.
We're not 30, I guess 20?
Yeah.
20?
You were 15.
Yeah. So at a certain point, it's like, no. this is not just like my own thing
right.
that I can't emerge from. It's important for me to say, I feel this way and this is why. It sucks and I shouldn't, but like we all need to say, you should have, you know what I mean?
Right.
And not be like, you gotta fix this, you know what I mean? Instead, it's more important that we understand why children can feel that way.
Right.
And then why grown-ass, dope-ass adults have to feel that way too. You know, like that's the thing. And really it's about the perpetuation and like the ways that little things that, you know, obviously I'm not on the playground anymore.
Right.
But there are little teeny bits.
Of course.
Of all of that, that like follows through. It's like, I see it on a movie or, you know, like some girl bumps into me and like does her white hair
on
the subway.
Oh, girl, I would snatch that hair on the subway, girl.
Oh my God. Like what? I'm sorry.
Oh, I hate it too.
I'm sorry.
I mean, I'm just saying I hate it too. Like,
so, you know, it's like it's stuff that, and really a lot of this book was like, here's all the stuff that bothers me that shouldn't, you know what I mean? But like, this is why, and it should bother everyone
Everybody.
That yeah. it bothers me, you know? Like I really do think that my problems are very American problems. And that feels empowering to say.
Absolutely.
Because most of my life, I have felt that my problems are my problems.
Yours alone.
Mm-hmm.
And to that point, you talk about, and we don't have to get into the dating conversation because, you know, to be a black woman dating an American, I'm saying this even as a married black woman who's married to a black man, very black Nigerian man, it's a hot-ass mess. I say unless you're a black person with a womb dating another black person with a woman, then in that case, it's like very magical. But for everybody else, it's a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? And one of the things that you say, like when you talk about that, is like, this is not a Morgan issue. This is like a collective issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. Like, I agree that not only is that a collective issue, right? Is that so many of the issues that you bring up is not a Morgan issue. It's
mm-hmm.
a collective.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does it look like when we're doing community care? I really appreciate it, how you talk about your perspective of committing to like this, like, you know, group of men who are like platonic friends,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah,
with
the husbands,
right? And
men and non-binaries and all kinds of, I mean, half
are
married. There's like three husband babies, I think, at this point. I'm just an auntie to many, but
I love just in that moment, like, although brief, like. That agency and that power
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
you're claiming for yourself while even identifying like this is still a struggle and this is a real issue
mm-hmm.
and I want something else for myself. And so, and I think you put it back, you know, again, as opposed to like turning the lens on yourself, like you're turning it back outwards,
right?
What you do throughout the book is like you're turning like, I'm gonna, instead of it's like me, black girl with mental health issues,
right?
You know, I got to figure out by myself and spend all this money on therapy,
mm-hmm.
which I absolutely think is important, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But you're turning the lens back onto American society
right.
as like, I am also a product of
yes.
you.
Why am I here in the first place? You know what I mean? Yeah, I think, you know, being a young black teen diagnosed with depression, obviously, you know, in white school, and it was like a secret, even like with our family, it really was never something that I felt allowed to interrogate as a cultural situation, you know? And instead, it really was like, something is wrong with me. Like, I have a disease, and so there, I'm just like, I just have to take these pills, and I have to, you know, go to these appointments. So it has been, and I think that's kind of like, almost like the case study for the rest of the book of like, me getting older and being able to look back and at all the things that I thought were my fault and kind of undo that, kind of like unbraid everything and see and, you know, bring it back to the beginning, which is usually just like, oh, slave ship, there we go. That's how we got here. You know, like it really was something long before me.
Mm-hmm.
That has been really powerful. But to your point, the other part of that is, you know, tracing so much trauma back to the slave ship. And then, you know, the other part of the book is tracing even further back, right?
Mm-hmm.
To our agency and Africanness.
Right.
So both are necessary. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you have to trace back in order to then be like, wait, there's before, you know, because so much of our identity in America is our American identity, right? Mm-hmm. Not just like our identity. So usually we're pointing things back to when did we get here and how and, you know, in whose chains. But then there is something, we were alive before. Mm-hmm. So I think the book kind of became this way of, yes, reaching back and always just kind of like hitting the wall of the slave ship. And in so doing, allowing me to then kind of like push past that and get a glimpse, though blurry, of what was before and therefore what could be possible in the future. You know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. if we're just stuck in from ship to ship, we're not going anywhere.
Oh, no.
You know? But if we can kind of look beyond, we maybe see a freedom.
Absolutely.
Heaven forbid. You know what I mean? But I do think that, yes, it is possible to find those spaces. I just think that they happen in smaller ways. At least for me right now, I'm finding those free of whiteness spaces to be more like temporal and kind of like curated almost, which, you know, we could start there. I don't know that, you know, I don't know that right now we could be like, let's establish a city, you know, where we don't worry about it. But I can have friends over for where like 2 hours, we just maybe don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. We just don't even think about it, you know? I've been to Cave Canem, writing retreat with, it's like a week long and it's like only Black writers. Sometimes there are other groups on the like campus. But 1 year I was there and there was not. And so I only saw Black people for a week. And it was, and then when I got on the train, it's like outside of Pittsburgh, so I got on the train, it's like a lot of different people, like a lot. And was like, oh, like it was weird. Because to have that experience, that's not something that we usually have, that you're just like only around 50 Black people for a week. Like no other intervening, no doorman, no mailman, no nothing, you know, just like us. And that we can create those spaces, you know, where we like momentarily forget. But it is a thing where it relies on intentionality.
Absolutely.
You know?
And again, Big Cousin, they exist.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
is
yeah.
curated.
But
we
have to make our bubble.
We
yeah.
have to create it and we have the power to do so. And I just say that because I'm like, oh, it makes me want to beat up. Like when my niece came and she was just like, oh, like these little, you know, like, there were little white girls that were, you know, didn't want to invite her or something. I was like, what the, like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Kids. You know what I mean? Like just even for making her feel that way
yes.
as a child.
Yeah.
And so even as an adult, I still feel that way today. And I'm mm-hmm. like, we have those bubbles. They exist. And we're going to continue to create it.
Right.
What do you in all of, and
but
like,
I was sorry to even cut you off. But on top of that, I'm growing up in the 90s when it's all about assimilation.
Yeah.
You know? So there's a way that it's like, I don't know, man. It's really complicated, you know? Because growing up in this time of like, we're all, you know, Benetton, whatever, I think there is a sub-psychology where if we're always reaching for that, and, you know, yeah, that's my generation, that my parents coming from, a generation of like, respectability politics mm-hmm. and like, you know, they grew up poor, they're just trying to get to the suburbs, you know,
right.
like who could fault them, you
right.
know? So it's all wrapped up in that mm-hmm. also, that's like, we're supposed to have this aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And so to feel like you're barred entry then kind of complicates creating your own space, if that makes sense.
It does. If you, I mean, again, I really appreciate the ways that you talk about therapy in your book. My therapist is actually Indian. He's not a Black woman. And he's fucking amazing.
Love him.
Love him. I'm like, God bless his name and no one else. I don't know if y'all ever saw Head of State with Chris Rock when he says, God bless America and no place else. Just watch it. It's funny. So it's like another inside joke. But what would you tell with the life you've lived to date? And again, I don't think healing, I've done a lot of work around healing from generational trauma mm-hmm. and, you know, molestation and all of that stuff. And I feel like healing is not a destination, but a journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you were alluding to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What would you go back and tell little bitty Morgan, who I want to give a nice big hug to and say, fuck them damn kids. What would you tell her with what all of the work that you've done on yourself to date?
Oh, such a hard question. I mean, I think this book is, this book, the last book, the one book, you know what I mean? Like, I think that I'm constantly trying to send her missives, you know? And there are ways, when I wrote my young adult, I really did feel, I literally was like, I'm literally trying to finish this so that I can give it to this child. I'm really trying to go back in time and correct some shit and like hand this to her because she needed it. And I mean, so, okay. I feel like this is like a very unorthodox and like not what you're supposed to do, which is like read the very end of the book. You know, it's like, I mean, you guys still have to buy it, but you guys still have to buy it. Reparations. I changed the order of this book a lot. It was really a weird process of putting it together, but the last essay changed, but the last piece of it I knew was going to be the end for a while. Mm-hmm. So there was a way that I was writing toward that kind of statement or conclusion, mm-hmm. and like trying to earn it. Mm-hmm. And I think as I was, you know, writing toward that, that kind of became the destination, mm-hmm. and the like internalizing and believing and, you know, signing off on that became like the personal destination and the destination of the book. This is just 2 cents. This poetry we make from our own ashes and myths is an art of survival and glory too. Just that. I think part of it is like understanding my trauma as connected to things, but also understanding my glory as inevitable, you know what I mean? As predestined. That I think is, we don't get to hear or say that enough, you know? I think for me, that was really the story here. I think also, you know, the acceptance to feel the pain of that trauma. But with that acceptance of that pain comes the acceptance of the glory, you know? So for me, it's a hope that those two things can happen simultaneously, you know? That through looking back and claiming the hurt, we can also claim what has been ours from the beginning.
Absolutely. That's a way to drop a mic. Can y'all give Morgan a huge round of applause?
Thank you, sister.
But just thinking about what she was saying, right, about the persons, right? And so I was diagnosed with borderline personality. Now that she was talking about it, I was like, that got something to do with slavery, you know what I'm saying? Or the enslaved mind,
mm-hmm.
you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And that person that I be trying to create, like you were saying, creating things to try to be normal.
Hmm.
And the fact that she was saying about the slave ships and how it ends there. And that's why when I say the Bible, I believe in the Bible. Our history goes back, I believe, in the Bible. Just the thought of, you know what I'm saying? When I got here, right, I wasn't even supposed to be here. That's why I knew there's a higher power, you know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Because mm-hmm. I had to bring a book back, and I wound up here to bring it back. You know what I'm saying? Because that's where I got it from.
You were supposed to be here.
And that's why I figured when y'all was talking, I'm like, wow, how I get here, you know what I'm saying? Thank you for finding us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much. This is so wonderful. I was wondering, Morgan, if you could talk a little bit more about the like the order that these essays came to you in, and you know, we love to say start at the beginning, and for those of us maybe, you know, venturing into essays for the first time, like, did you actually start at the beginning? Where'd you start? Where'd you end, actually? Can you share that information?
Yeah.
The final lines stay the final lines.
It was like a long, yeah, I mean, the final, at some point I had that, and then it helped me order the book, but the book started in a few different ways. I wrote an essay that was in the New York Times in, I think, 2014, 2015. It was about, you know, how we should have therapy as reparations. And there's kind of some notes about me being in the therapist's office and kind of understanding I've spent all this time talking about America. You know what I mean? Pay me. You know what I mean? I was supposed to be talking about my intimacy issues, but, you know, that's delayed. And that, you know, kind of got me started on what are we doing here? You know what I mean? And then thinking about how much of my mental illness has been informed by my African-American oppression, you know? So that piece and the kind of argument around it became pulled out through the book. So now there's like several different therapy. I always say that the book is, it's not really a memoir, but the parts that are most memoir-y is me in a therapist's office. So, you know, every once in a while you're like, oh, there I am with my first therapist, then I am in college with my therapist, then I am, you know, therapist in 2014. So it became a project of really trying to bring the reader along that experience of mirroring my personal psychological journey with my country's journey at the same time. So kind of giving cultural context and then also looking at how that's affecting the interior. So then it was kind of like fill in the blanks from there. And I had a few other pieces that were previously published, and none of them I like copied and pasted. They were all, I like went and did a bunch more because she can't let well enough alone. But that kind of became the project of it, the kind of skeleton of it. The other part was this idea of the slave ship as a metaphor for like a kind of economic situation that we're stuck in. And that was kind of like me watching the Big Pimpin' video and then thinking about legacies of slavery, you know what I mean? So yeah, like they're really kind of understanding the threads that I wanted to play with and then taking those lenses to the personal essay instead of saying, I'm gonna write an essay about, you know, this year of my life and then try to find the themes therein, if that makes sense, yeah.
I want to thank you both for your light, your effervescence, your energy.
Thank you.
And as a Taurus, I believe I'm a very peaceful person. Mm-hmm. But lately I've just been very angry about everything. Mm-hmm. Like literally everything. I went to hot yoga, that wasn't working. I listened to Mama's Gun 1,000 times, that wasn't working.
And that didn't work.
Erica didn't work. But I taken baths to like cool my head, and I went to my altar, and it was just like, write about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been transmuting it through writing, or like at least trying my best not to just say the same thing over and over.
Mm-hmm. Although sometimes that's how it starts.
Hey,
saying the same thing over and over,
excellent.
You know?
Excellent, thank you. Question to both of you is, I'll speak into it. My question to both of you is it in fact time for revolution? I probably already know the answer to this, but is it time for revolution? And if so, what is the role of the writer and what is the role of the healer?
Excellent questions. Big old questions. I mean, I'm ready. I can't buy a gun because I'll kill myself with it. You know what I mean? Like, that is what it is. You know what I mean? I can't have a gun. So someone's got to stand in front of me with their gun. But I'll tell the truth all fucking day. You know what I mean? All day I'll tell the truth. That's the only thing I can do. You know, it's really, all I can do is point, you know? But that's really not an easy thing to do all the time. You know, is point to and say, look what we see right there. no, don't, like, look again, you know? That, I think that really becomes the role of the writer is, you know, witnessing, yes, but directional pointing, you know? Look here. Don't look over there. Look there. And keep looking, you know? For me, that feels like the most powerful. When I'm writing and feeling like I'm forcing a reader to look at something that they don't want to, that feels like a particular type of power that could be wielded toward revolution.
I love that. So I, what I didn't talk about was, you know, my life as a Yoruba priest. I initiated in Brooklyn in 2015 to the Orisha Shango Kawo Kabiosile, who is the god of thunder and lightning. And I feel like we have tried as strategies many things, mm-hmm. economics, education, the arts.
Mm-hmm.
What we have been in, one of the things I was going to ask you, but we didn't really get to, was the role of the ancestors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm going to keep pushing back. I feel like somebody has to, because mm-hmm. if not, then sometimes we could just fall into despair.
Mm-hmm.
But I have seen another way of possibility through
yeah.
my ancestral, like, veneration, through the technology that is ancestral veneration. I am a witch. I'm mm-hmm. a hoodooist. And we all have power.
Mm-hmm.
Haitians were able to win the revolution by starting off at Bois Kamein with the sacrifice of a black pig to their gods, to the Loa, to these Vodou, these powers from Benin. And they asked them to give them power over and victory over who at the time was the most powerful military force in the world, Napoleon and his military.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I think without proselytizing, my role is to remind us, bring us back to ourselves, back to the traditions of what existed before those
mm-hmm.
ships,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
what was maintained even in the bowels of those
yes,
ships.
Yes, yes, that's what, yes, survived, what we're able to hold on to. Yeah, yeah.
On those plantations that our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers understood and knew, and what those great-greats, and when we talk about that old-time religion, what they were really doing and practicing and believing, and how they were using that, like that, those old guys and those old ways of being and that old technology to create another destiny for themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then my role, like I said, is not to proselytize, but then to equip people with tools that we have access mm-hmm. to. We remember, it's in our DNA.
Yeah, we know.
Right? It's like, oh, this is how you use an altar. This is how you sit at an altar. You can't get beyond that wall in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
You talk to them.
Yep, yep.
And then they will show you and speak to you. They'll come to you in dreams mm-hmm. and they will manifest in different ways in your life so that you then have access to them and the information that comes with that. So that's at least what I'm doing, you know, and that's my charge to other people as well. And I think as we look at what's going on in Haiti, in the Congo, in the Middle East, right, in Gaza,
mm-hmm.
Until we end white supremacy, this planet will burn.
I mean, yeah.
Okay, the moon, Saturn, Pluto, Mars will also burn, because if people go up there with white supremacist ideas and try to colonize outer space, it's going to burn too. And so until we stamp out white supremacy, right, across the board, we will all suffer. And I don't think that's just our responsibility to do alone,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We need to be figuring it out collectively,
yeah.
right? Because we didn't create this mess that we find ourselves in. So folks got work to do.
Yeah. But as you said, it's not the first time we've been in a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And I do find the one thing about writing this book is that I just was always looking back. And obviously looking back and finding, you know, moments of despair, but also finding we made it, you know what I mean?
We
surpassed. And there are ways that we did that, you know what I mean? What are the ways that we did it before? That was something that I was, and I went back to, you know, June and Zora, and like, how are they talking about these things? And like, what is Nikki talking about? And what was the role of the writer in these other times of, you know, near revolution, basically. And that's really how I have been able to like open myself to being, I mean, the thing is, I'm a writer, but sometimes I'm a vessel, you know what I mean? And like, there's things I've written that I'm like, I didn't write that. I didn't write that. I'm blacked out. Ancestors came down. They wrote it for me, and then I just stand up and read them. You know, like that's crazy. But that really is. It's that other thing, the knowing. So yeah, it is about like leaving an openness to be informed, right? Like, yeah.
That part. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.